This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
For years, South Sudan struggled to gain their independence. Now it is struggling for survival. Rarely have such high hopes been squandered so quickly.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon talking about the situation in South Sudan. Details coming up.
Also, more than 150 people have been rescued and 42 are confirmed dead off Egypt's Mediterranean coast.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, dozens of migrants are feared dead after their boat capsized off of Egypt's Mediterranean coast. The overloaded fishing boat carrying mostly African migrants overturned on Wednesday, about 12 kilometers from the Egyptian city of Rosetta. More than 150 people have been rescued and 42 are confirmed dead. Authorities say they expect the death toll to rise, as witnesses say around 100 people sought refuge in the boat's cold storage room as the vessel flipped over. Four suspected traffickers have been arrested following the tragedy. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following the story and spoke with me about the latest developments in a string of disasters to hit those undertaking the perilous sea crossing to Europe.
Well, the boat was apparently carrying around 600 passengers and capsized around 12 nautical miles off the northern coast of Egypt near the town of Bourg Rashid, where the Nile River meets the Mediterranean. So far, rescue workers have saved the lives of more than 150 people, but there are fears for the hundreds who are still believed to be missing. Now, exhausted survivors from the capsized boat have told the BBC they were in the water for up to 8 hours, even though they had sent an SOS. And there were people there telling horrifying stories of survival and also talking about loved ones that they'd lost already that they knew had disappeared on that vessel. The boat is believed to have sunk because it was carrying far more people than it should have been, and that's what officials have told reporters.
I understand that some of those victims were one child, 10 women, and 31 young men who lost their lives during this capsizing.
We're still trying to find out more information. We know the boat was carrying Egyptians, Sudanese, Eritreans, and Somali migrants. Certainly there were some young Egyptians on board. One fellow called Mohammed told the BBC that he had said the Muslim prayer of death 10 to 15 times, preparing to die. And he said that he had lost his 14-year-old cousin, Mahmoud, on that vessel. So more stories are coming to light, but it certainly sounds quite terrifying and very upsetting, as many of these people came from poor villages in that part of Egypt, which doesn't have a lot of opportunities at the moment.
Also, authorities have arrested four suspected traffickers following this tragedy. Do you know the status of that?
We understand Egyptian authorities have arrested at least four people in connection with the deaths on this vessel. They're believed to be members of the crew and have been remanded in police custody for several days pending further investigation, but they face charges of human trafficking and manslaughter. The Egyptian authorities have also issued arrest warrants for five others wanted in connection with this tragedy. The Egyptian military is monitoring the situation. The governor of the local province, Mohammed Sultan, says that authorities still don't have a precise number of the victims. Indeed, they may never know just how many were on board this vessel, but they certainly believe between 250 and 400 may be missing.
Egypt is not the usual turning point for migrants to leave from. And I understand that the EU's border agency Frontex had warned that growing numbers of people would be leaving from Egypt. So are we going to see more and more people leaving from Egypt?
It's certainly a worrying trend. If their focus is Europe, which of course it is, if that focus is Italy, which it generally is, the distance from Egypt to Italy is nearly twice as far. It's around 1,000 miles compared to the distance from Libya, where many of the vessels have been coming up until now. So this incident comes just as the head of the EU's border agency was warning that increasing numbers of Europe-bound migrants are using Egypt as a departure point. And not only Africans, but Egyptians who feel that there are very few opportunities for them in Egypt, looking to make that perilous journey to Europe in search of other opportunities.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
At the UN General Assembly meetings in New York, a session was held today on the health of migrants and refugees. Italy and Sri Lanka hosted the event. Italy's representative outlined the scope of the migrant and refugee crisis.
The massive arrival of undocumented migrants and refugee asylum seekers from North Africa and from the Middle East is under our eyes. It cannot be denied any longer. Nor can it be denied that we are facing a global crisis exacerbated by the social and political unrest of many countries of the Mediterranean area, as well as of other regions. The crisis' net result is a growing population of economic and climate migrants, as well as of refugees and asylum seekers.
The Italian official spoke of the differences among migrants and refugees heading to Europe from different regions.
Tangible differences have been noted between migrants coming from the Middle East and moving to Central European countries and those who come by the sea. The former are families and organized population groups. The latter are mainly individuals coming from a variety of countries, sometimes infiltrated by criminal organizations. The male proportion has decreased recently in favor of females and unaccompanied children and teens, whose needs are even more challenging. A week ago, the 53 WHO Euro member states have adopted a regional strategy, an action plan, and a resolution on public health and migration. This comprehensive package, the first of its kind worldwide, aims at providing quality and universal assistance to the refugees and migrants who have often suffered a traumatic journey, do not speak the local language, and are fearful. The plan aims at eliminating barriers to health care, such as language, administrative hurdles, and lack of information about health entitlements, and takes account of cultural and religious differences.
Also addressing the UN session on refugees and migrant health was Dr. Peter Salama, Executive Director of the World Health Organization's Health Emergencies Program. He focused on what he called complex issues.
The first is the balance of ensuring that people in any legal category, refugees, migrants, whether regular or irregular, all have their right to health care met, on one hand. But on the other hand, ensuring the specific and at times very different needs of different demographic groups are recognized and met. In many situations, of course, the majority of refugees are women and children, and their health needs and indeed opportunities for access will vary greatly from, say, the irregular migrants, predominantly young men, languishing in detention centres across North Africa. So specific tailored approaches are needed, and this will require a detailed understanding of context in source, transit, or destination countries.
The WHO official also said countries hosting refugees for long periods face a healthcare burden.
As crises become more and more protracted, and countries such as Lebanon and Jordan face situations where up to one in four or five of their population are refugees themselves, the majority being outside camp situations, there'll only be one way to meet their needs: to open up the health system to all, while at the same time strengthening its capacity for serving both host and refugee populations.
Dr. Salama added that the migrant and refugee crisis is made more complicated by the flight of healthcare workers.
With the unprecedented systematic targeting of health workers and facilities in Syria and other Middle Eastern countries, I believe we may well see an increasing exodus of medical workers due to these grave violations of international humanitarian law, fearing for their professional lives and their lives in general. So far, for example, according to the Physicians for Human Rights, there have been more than 400 attacks on health facilities in the Syrian war and more than 750 medical workers killed, including two nights ago in southern Aleppo.
The World Health Organization is recommending that the short-term humanitarian response is accompanied by sustainable long-term healthcare approaches. It also says universal healthcare should be provided to migrants and refugees, regardless of their legal status.
Nigeria's president is asking for UN help in negotiating the release of up to 170 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram militants. Muhammadu Buhari made the request yesterday in New York in a meeting with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Boko Haram abducted 276 girls from a school in Chibok in April 2014. Most remain missing. A faction of the group has offered to trade the girls for a large number of insurgents being held in Nigerian prisons. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 16 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. More than 150 migrants have been rescued and 42 are confirmed dead off Egypt's Mediterranean coast. The health of migrants and refugees took center stage today at the UN General Assembly meeting in New York. And Nigeria's president is asking for UN help in negotiating the release of the schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram militants. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Health is a top priority at the UN General Assembly meetings this week in New York. In between sessions, VOA's Adam Phillips met with Nigeria's health minister, Professor Isaac Adewale. He spoke about the UN meetings on health and the health situation in Nigeria.
What is particularly significant to us, we have the Stop TB meeting. We had meetings on reproductive health, and we also had a session on antimicrobial resistance, which is an important thing for us in Africa. And this evening, we try to look at the polio situation in the world to develop a renewed commitment to ending polio in 2017. We're looking forward to being certified polio-free next year. We thought we were very close, and we had these two cases first in July and another one in August. As a health minister, I was shattered.
I understand that it was actually the polio vaccination program that enabled the Ebola to be sort of contained more quickly.
It's not the polio vaccination program, but the architecture. And so when Ebola landed, we had people who were trained for surveillance, for tracking contacts, and we deployed them immediately. And that's why we were able to quickly contain Ebola in Lagos and Port Harcourt.
What is the relationship between getting health out, especially to the countryside, and other areas of concern, such as infrastructure, education, etc.? I mean, I'm sure you must work very closely with your other ministers.
Well, certainly. If you ask me, all these are interrelated. When you look at public health problems, other issues, maternal mortality, child mortality, ability to really visit care facilities, it is tied to education. It is tied to economic well-being and infrastructure, making sure that the economy is in good shape. When you invest in health, you contribute substantially to the economic development of the nation.
Is it a big part of your strategy to employ and train community health workers? I'm curious because, you know, they already have the trust of the people. Is that sort of a key part of what you do?
We're looking at a nurse midwife-led primary care system. We do not have enough doctors to deploy to the rural areas. So we are going to use nurse midwives, we are going to use community health workers, village health workers, and we are going to really encourage people to be their primary care provider.
Tell me a little bit about mental health and how you view mental health in Nigeria. Here, the sort of the lines between mental health and physical health is becoming less distinct, and people, some of the stigma is leaving the idea of mental health. Well, is that part of your program?
I think this is one area where we have not done too well. We tend to see mental health as separate, but the new focus is to integrate mental health even to the community level. We need to really integrate. We need to let people know that it's one and the same. And when we invest in integrated programs, we'll save money, we will reduce waste, and get better results.
Is there any kind of effort to integrate traditional medicine and healing with the national healthcare approach?
We do not have a clear-cut strategy to do that, but what we really want to do is to look into our traditional herbal preparations. We know that quite a number of our traditional medicines, our traditional leaves, herbs, herbal vital remedies for many of the ailments that we have. And we want to invest in this, link them to our research institutions, where we can look into the active ingredients and produce them locally for the use of our people. But we also do not want to pretend that we know all that goes on within the traditional medical system. There's a lot of secrecy, there are no records, and so we do not have, as of now, any plan to celebrate the traditional system.
Any last words you want to say looking forward for the next year or even 10 years?
Well, I think it's important to reassure Nigerians and indeed Africans that we start implementing a program that will lead to the achievement of universal coverage in Africa.
That was Professor Isaac Adewule, Nigeria's Minister of Health. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips at the United Nations in New York.
Also, at the UN today, a high-level meeting was held on the violence and humanitarian crisis in South Sudan. UN Secretary General opened the session.
For years, South Sudan struggled to gain their independence. Now it is struggling for survival. Rarely have such high hopes been squandered so quickly. Time and again, the country's leaders have resorted to weapons and identity politics to resolve their differences. The children, women, and men of South Sudan are paying with their lives. Violent attacks have killed tens of thousands of people and forced some 2.6 million people to flee their homes. And this includes more than 1 million people who have sought refuge in neighboring countries. 6 million people are in need of aid, half of the population.
Mr. Ban says 1 million South Sudanese children are not able to attend school and nearly 5 million people face severe food shortages.
I visited and I saw for myself the fear and despair of some of the 200,000 men and women, boys and girls who are sheltering in UN protection sites. Hundreds of thousands of others are destitute, roaming the bush, or sheltering with extended family, friends, or strangers. Unbelievably, the situation has deteriorated since my visit in February. Violence has erupted again in many parts of the country, forcing people from their homes. Rape is being perpetrated on a mass scale. Over a two-week period in July, at least 217 cases of sexual violence were documented in Juba alone. 63 aid workers have been killed since the beginning of the crisis. Many others have been harassed, abused, detained, and arrested. In one heinous attack on the Terrain Hotel in July, a humanitarian worker was killed, and others were raped, sexually assaulted, and beaten. I have launched a special investigation into the response by United Nations peacekeeping troops to the violence in July. But the full responsibility for these crimes lies with the perpetrators.
The UN Secretary General says humanitarian agencies continue to provide aid, but face a severe funding shortfall of $700 million.
Humanitarians can only fulfill their mandate if parties to the conflict respect their independence and if there's no military solution to this conflict, only greater misery and suffering for the many at the hands of the few. I urge everyone in this room with the influence to use every opportunity to exert pressure on the parties and their leaders to reverse the slight need. The parties must uphold the peace agreement they signed more than a year ago and move toward rebuilding this fractured young nation. In the meantime, we cannot stand by as the people of South Sudan suffer.
That's UN Chief Ban Ki-moon speaking at a high-level meeting today on South Sudan.
In Zimbabwe, five protesters were charged yesterday with intent to breach the peace and promote violence and bigotry. The defendants are members of the National Electoral Reform Agenda, a coalition of 18 opposition political parties. They were arrested during weekend demonstrations in Harare against President Robert Mugabe's economic policies. They also called for his resignation. Despite a court ruling against government bans on demonstrations, police have battled marchers with tear gas canisters on several occasions.
A coalition of human rights groups called on African Union leaders today to abandon consideration of plans to urge withdrawal of its members from the International Criminal Court. Last April, a committee convened within the AU and recommended withdrawal from the ICC unless it meets three conditions, one of which was immunity from prosecution for heads of state and other senior officials. The coalition, led by U.S.-based Human Rights Watch, said this call for immunity violates the African Union's Constitutive Act and goes against recent AU initiatives meant to stamp out corruption. Stella Nderingu of the Kenya section of International Commission of Jurists says AU efforts to undermine the only permanent criminal court for victims of atrocities are at odds with the AU's rejection of impunity and decision to make 2016 the AU's year of human rights. The rights groups say the blanket immunity for heads of states has never been a feature of international courts, and the decision to withdraw from the international court should be left up to each individual state. Many people in Africa, including some African leaders, have argued that the ICC is biased against Africa, as thus far it has focused on Africa. Of its 10 active investigations, only one is outside Africa. Kenya's government is among several in Africa that has considered leaving the ICC. Representatives from the AU are set to meet with the UN Security Council on Friday to discuss the potential exit. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you.
Mobile, mobile, mobile.
The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.